For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
I'm Brian Taylor, and I know many of you, but not all of you. Are any of you relatively new to this Sangha? Well, welcome. Welcome, Mark. Nice to have you with us. And Ashley, I don't think we've met yet, but I've seen you in your little box. What was that old show, Hollywood Squares? That was really old. That really dates me, doesn't it? This is sort of like Hollywood Squares.
Well, I watched Hollywood Squares. It's not that old.
Did you like it, Alex? Tonight, I'm going to be giving a talk that actually I gave 10 days ago on Wednesday evening, and I know that some of you were there, but some of us at Ancient Dragon do this, where we give a talk, the same talk in two different settings. That was a Wednesday night with the Hyde Park Zen group, which I'm a part of, and then and here. So if you were there, I don't know, you could go out for a beer or you could stay and listen, and maybe you'll hear something different or I'll say something different. I don't know, but it's maybe it's even worth repeating. So my talk tonight is on daily life as forms and ceremonies. As bodhisattvas, especially when we receive the precepts, as I did a few years ago, one of our many vows that we take is to embrace and sustain forms and ceremonies. Now, in our Sangha and in others, sometimes that's translated differently as to embrace and sustain right conduct. But I'm going to stick with the other translation of it, which is to embrace and sustain forms and ceremonies, because of the way I'm going to approach it tonight. When we think about forms and ceremonies, I know that Alex spoke about this not too long ago, forms and ceremonies of the Zendo, that from the very beginning in the Soto Zen tradition, when we walk into a Soto Zen temple, there are forms. I mean, we bow to the greeter. The greeter eventually strikes the han with a wooden mallet. We bow as we enter the Zendo. We go in a direction around the altar and not crossing in front of it. We bow to our seat. We turn counterclockwise and we turn on top of our cushion. And you know, those forms are important, which I'm going to be getting into. Some people, I guess, when they're new to it, some people feel like it's a kind of a fussy or rigid type thing. I've always found that those forms, when we do them together, especially when people are really kind of in harmony with each other and attuned to each other's presence, I've always felt that it creates this sense of like a dance. We're all in this together and we're doing one thing as one. And there's a real beauty to it, and it brings me more into the present moment. So those are some of the forms and ceremonies in the Zendo, and the way we eat, you know, in a session or a day-long retreat or longer, with the bowls and sitting at our cushion called Oryoki. That's a form as well. It has its own set of things that we do, rituals. And ritual, I suppose, is another word you could use for this. But you know, we don't live in the Zendo, and we're not monks, and we don't live in a monastery where there are a lot of forms and ceremonies to be observed. We are lay people who our life is lived in our own home for most of us, and often with other people in the home, or at least one other person, or pets. We go to a job often. We are, you know, go and do our own grocery shopping, things like that. Unlike, you know, we're not cloistered away in a monastery somewhere. We live in the world fully. And most of our daily life is spent doing the kinds of things that everybody else does in the world. It's not filled with forms and ceremonies. But what I want to really bring up tonight is that is really ask the question for lay people, for us, what are our normal forms and ceremonies in everyday life? How do we engage with them, and what happens when we do? First of all, it probably should be said that Zazen is the primary form or ceremony that we practice, even as lay people in the world, even if we're not monks. Those of us who are dedicated to a practice try to do it most every day. And at least for me, there's a ritual to that. You know, there's a certain time and a certain place, and there's a way in which I go about it in terms of settling myself on the cushion and so forth. But the thing that in our Soto tradition that is kind of unique is that we look at this form of doing Zazen, the physical doing of it, sitting down on the cushion and just doing it, that it is an expression of an awakening that is already present. It is not a means towards awakening. That Ehe Dogen, the founder of our tradition in Japan, held that from the very first, even an inexperienced person sitting Zazen even for a moment expresses awakening along with all beings. There is something in the physical doing of it that enacts this, that expresses this. Kaz Ta-Nehisi, on a commentary on Dogen, said, at the moment you begin taking a step, you have arrived. And you keep arriving each moment thereafter. In this view, you don't journey towards enlightenment, but you let enlightenment unfold. And so Zazen is a form or a ceremony or a rite that we practice, not like a piano player practicing scales really hard all the time and getting better and better and faster at doing scales, until they get to the point where they can actually play a piece by Mozart beautifully, you know, years down the road. That's not what we're doing in Zazen. We are enacting by the act of sitting down in the posture that has been handed down to us through tradition, with uprightness, eyes partly open, hands in the mudra of the position, the Buddha mudra or universal mudra, we are enacting something physically, like a yoga position that has its own activity. We don't make that happen by our mental state, by arriving in a certain mental state. And Dainin Katagiri, one of my favorite teachers who was in Minneapolis for many years, said it this way: leaving the way to the way, leaving Zazen to Zazen, leaving one step to one step, this is the true way to attain the way. This is all we have to do. So we leave Zazen to Zazen instead of trying to make it something special happen. And it does its work. Buddha becomes Buddha. Buddha is Buddha when we sit. Now, I want to shift gears a little bit in a way that's very related to this in a different tradition. Historically, the Christian sacramental churches, and by sacramental, the ones that, you know, celebrate the Mass, and other sacraments of the church, and those are Anglican churches, Roman Catholic, and Orthodox churches, they have developed their own version of what I'm talking about with Zazen in their form, their understanding of their forms and ceremonies, especially the sacramental ceremonies. And it's the Latin term that was developed many, many centuries ago for this is ex opere operato. Ex opere operato is literally means from the operation operating, or from the work performed. From the work performed, ex opere operato. And what it means is that the sacraments carry their own effect. It is not what they carry and what they communicate and what happens for participants is not dependent on the spiritual condition of the people who celebrate them. And I won't go into a long history of how that doctrine developed, but it really came about just briefly because there were people who were convinced that certain other Christians and clergy in particular were not pure. And because they weren't pure, their sacraments were invalid. And this suggested that we have to kind of put ourselves in a certain kind of state in order to receive the benefits of this practice. And that's maybe what some people think about meditation sometimes, that we have to kind of gain a certain purity in order for it to be any good, for it to do any good for us. So with ex opere operato, it's saying that something is given in the action of the rite, in the doing of the rite. Zazen does Zazen. Buddha does Buddha. The way accomplishes the way. And in terms of the Christian Mass, what is accomplished and what happens in that rite is that there is union with Christ and union with one another. Very similar to what we say about Buddha and all beings when we sit Zazen. It happens. It happens. However, it's also not magic. It's not as if a person in a sacramental church who is opposed to everything that God stands for and, you know, can just take communion as a kind of a joke or as an act of spite, and poof, they're filled with the Spirit of God somehow, the Spirit of divine love. It's not magic. And so the way that the sacramental churches have understood that is that a person must be properly disposed to receiving the sacrament. In other words, their intention is to be open, to receive what it has to offer. There is a relationship between the energy of the sacrament itself and the energy of the participant who comes to it with an open mind and open heart. And so it is, I think, in Zazen, if you will. It's not like, you know, I mean, we've all spent a large part of our lives daydreaming, you know. And if you're just sitting around on a rock somewhere and daydreaming about this, that, and the other thing, or worrying, or thinking about how you're going to get back at so-and-so because they dissed you at work or something, I mean, that's not Zazen. That's just sitting there. Physically, you may be doing the same thing. You may have been sitting with a straight spine, but you're not bringing to that moment the intentionality, the openness, the willingness to let Zazen become Zazen, to let Buddha become Buddha. And so there's a relationship between our energy and the energy that the act itself brings forth. So Zazen is, as I said, I think the primary form or ceremony for a layperson. We do this most days. We go into a certain place, we sit down at a certain time, and we enact this rite, and it has its effect over time. But what are those other forms and ceremonies for a layperson, and how do they have their own kind of action or grace, if you will? Since we don't live in a monastery, I think that most of our forms and ceremonies are what we think of as worldly affairs. In other words, how we spend our days. We interact with a partner or with a pet or with the plants in our apartment. We do chores around the house. We may do physical labor for a living. We may answer emails and sit in front of a computer screen for a living. We may deal frequently with difficult circumstances, difficult people, with stress, sometimes illness. We all fix food. We cook. We take out the garbage. In other words, everything that we do all day long can be seen as forms and ceremonies. And what I mean by that is, you know, it's just one thing to do these things just to get them done. And sometimes we do. I mean, I do a lot of that. You know, you take out the garbage to take out the garbage. But what happens when we bring intentionality to it and say, this is, I am here now doing this, and I am in the world that surrounds me, and there are other people, and there's a sky above me, and there's, and this food is now going to a dump site. Here I am doing this thing. It becomes kind of a right. You know, I don't know much about this, and Tigan, maybe you do, having grown up with some Jewish practice, but my understanding of at least some of the traditions in Judaism is that there are a lot of prayers that are available that can be said before almost any action that one takes. You know, most of us are familiar with people who say grace before a meal is eaten. But what about a prayer that might be said before you go to the bathroom? A prayer before you go to bed at night? A prayer the first thing when you wake up and you open your eyes? Those are all ways of making an ordinary experience into a rite or a form or a ceremony. We know that from, you know, in the Zendo, we chant a short chant. If we have a meal, those of us who have done full day or longer sessions, there's something powerful about bringing our intention to that moment by doing a chant and saying yes to it. And suddenly at home, when we might be just gobbling down a meal, if we stop for a moment and do something like we do in the Zendo, where there's a chant or some kind of a grace or blessing or something, then it becomes something very different. And it has... The moment, the action, has its own work that it does for us, with our energy that we bring to it. I think this is one way of looking at how we go about our daily life. You know, if we're going on an errand, there can be moments where suddenly it becomes something more than just getting it done, and we open up to the experience itself. It begins to bring about its own effects because it has its own energy. If we're in our car or on the L walking on the street and we're trying to get something done and we are delayed for whatever reason, or people are not kind to us, sometimes what happens is that we sort of stop and say, what am I doing here? What am I doing? What's happening here? And at that moment, the environment itself begins to work on us. We might hear the birds. We might see the sky. We might see other people who are impatient as struggling people and have some compassion on them. We might notice our own hurriedness, our own stress, and bring awareness into that stressful situation. And it becomes then something that impacts us by the environment itself impacts us. It's not like, now I'm going to be such and such a way. I'm going to be more patient. I'm going to be more this. I'm going to be more that in this moment here. It's that when we stop and make it intentional, the experience itself teaches us, and the way accomplishes the way. Sometimes this is called mindfulness or present moment awareness. And one thing about mindfulness that I've noticed recently in terms of my own approach to that, my own background with that, is that I'm afraid that sometimes mindfulness can be approached as something that I am doing for myself. I am bringing a mindful attitude into this moment so that I will feel more peaceful and I will really taste this orange and isn't that beautiful, so that I can have a beautiful experience for myself. And what I'm talking about doing is more opening up to whatever's there. And it might be our own emotional life. It might be the taste of the orange in that moment. It might be the sound of the wind going by as I'm biting into an orange. It might be somebody else who's around me who's stressed out, who says something when they walk by. The world is a dynamic place. And there's all this going on. And it has something to teach us if we realize that everything we're doing is a ceremony or a form and approach it that way and bring intentionality to it. It ex opere operato, it has its own power. So I want to close with this talk with something that I put together. And there are actually three of these posted on the website, on the homepage of Ancient Dragons website. And what they are things that I like to do sometimes where I take a certain teacher and I take notes on different things that they say that I like, and I put them in a document, and it's, you know, many pages long. And then eventually I begin to see maybe a theme, and I pull pieces of those quotations out and I rearrange them into a poem. And this one I did on the subject that I'm talking about tonight, with different passages from Dainin Katagiri. And I'm calling it "All Things Will Start to Talk with You." And they're all his words, but they're rearranged. Even if we don't understand Zen teaching, we can pay kind, compassionate attention to the things around us. We can deal with a vegetable with warm-heartedness, expressing the lively energy of our life and respecting the lively energy the vegetable also possesses. In Zen practice, we approach the activity of each moment with a clear and open mind, our own life interrelating with the life of all beings in the universe. Because this moment is unified, all living beings become the content of our minds, and at that time we realize our true self. So we pay careful attention to every aspect of daily life, getting up in the morning, washing our face, having breakfast, walking on the street. This is called creating our life and is very important. The most meaningful of Buddhist practices is to do small things every day with great hope, putting the seed in the desert regardless of whether it will grow or not. We don't know why, but in living this way, something penetrates our life. We can feel it. This is maturity. Maturity lets us live together with all sentient beings in peace and harmony. So just take one step in this moment with wholeheartedness. Allow all things to come and reside with your heart and mind, and they will function together as a whole. All things will open up and start to talk with you. This wonderful feeling is expressed beyond ideas and thoughts. So I'd very much like to hear what thoughts you might have, or questions, or your experiences of everyday life as form, ceremony, as forms and ceremonies. Taigen, yes.
Just to add to what you said, which I think is very helpful, in Buddhist monasteries, there are particular verses that are said for particular events, like before taking a bath, before brushing your teeth, before hitting the han, before at various particular times. Most of those verses are taken from a particular one chapter in the Flower Ornament Sutra that we're doing now, Friday evening, the first Friday evening of the month. Jason and Dylan have started a reading, so it's one of the chapters further along, but there are particular gathas or verses that are used at particular times in the monastery before washing your hands. And so in that spirit, I think it's possible to do that kind of practice in daily non-residential life. One example right now, I don't use those verses myself now, I use mantras and dharanis. So there are the Heart Sutra, which we chant somewhat regularly. There's a mantra instruction at the end, and there's the mantra, Gate Gate Paragate Parasam Gate Bodhisvaha. I find that and other mantras and dharanis very useful in the middle of the day when you have some feeling of stress or confusion or just whatever, something going on, just to pause and say that to yourself. once or twice or a few times. We have now this in our culture through COVID, this ceremony of washing our hands when we come in, and we've been told to sing or chant "Happy Birthday" twice. I've been chanting the Kanzeon twice, so we can use Buddhist chants twice. It's the equivalent, or there's various other dharanis or mantras I've been saying, to the equivalent time of "Happy Birthday" twice, washing my hands. There are lots of other examples. There are many other Buddhist mantras or dharanis that I've talked about. There's a chapter about them in the Lotus Sutra, but those or the gathas, reminders in that chapter in the Flower Ornament Sutra can be very helpful just in everyday activity, before crossing the street, before at some point when you feel tense, at some point when somebody says something to you that is provocative and you might react, but you can stop and pause. Or instead of a mantra, just to take a few breaths. So
right.
Another example, I used to work at Parallax Press, where they editing Thich Nhat Hanh's books, and they had this very strict practice. It got irritating at times, but whenever the phone rang, you had to stop whatever you were doing in the middle of a word or whatever and just take three deep breaths before you had picked up the phone. But that's an example. Or another example, my first teacher told me, whenever you walk through a door, take a couple of breaths. So there are all kinds of examples. So those were the kinds of things you were talking about, Brian, where you can use some situation as a mindfulness opportunity. And I like what you said. It's not about just mindfulness for yourself. It's for the whole situation around you. So I just wanted to add that to what you were saying. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So maybe people have questions or comments or things to add to that.
Just to say, as host, I think everyone knows, but you can either raise your hand or you can use the participant at the bottom. It's a small number. So I think, Brian, I think you can see everyone. Would you like to call on people as they raise their hand?
Yeah, or people could just jump in either way.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Mark, and then Ed.
Good evening. I'm very familiar through some of my practices throughout the years with the Benedictine monks and lay programs that they have for that. And rituals are nice. I struggle sometimes with if we're so rigid on doing the rituals every time, then that becomes a hindrance to a clear mind because it's like, oh, I got to do this now. And I would just kind of like your thought on where do you strike the balance of keeping the awareness for mindfulness throughout the day without it becoming a harness and reins that you're pulling behind.
Boy, that's a really good question, and I don't have an easy answer for you. It's interesting. That was one of the first comments that somebody brought up last Wednesday as well. Was the deadening potential for ritual? We know that from people who grow up in a rigid church environment, you know, just go to mass and shut up, you know, and don't even think about it, you know, sort of ex opere operato taking to its extreme, you know, you don't have to even think of it, just go, just do it, you know, however deadening it is, out of obedience. And that's not what we're talking about here, of course. But I think, you know, to respond to that, first of all, I think it's important for us to be somewhat flexible and to sometimes change things up as far as how we do things, how we bring mindfulness to the moment, or even in Zazen, how do we, you know, if we discover we're in a rut, to question that. And I don't have a lot of easy answers for that, but to notice, I'm deadening myself with this, aren't I? Or this doesn't feel very vital. It doesn't feel alive. Why is that? What's happening here? Which is just to question the use of right. Sometimes we have to work through that, and even though we're bored, to do it anyway, because it sort of has a kind of a fruit that comes over time if we do that. Sometimes a change needs to happen. Sometimes we're using the right itself in order to deaden ourselves, you know? Sometimes we're not really, it's not leading to a more awakened life. Sometimes it's numbing, and we have to look at that and ask ourselves, what's happening here? What am I doing? And I don't know, maybe some of you who have been practicing various kinds of ceremonies or forms in your life know, you know, you might respond to that a little differently. How would some of the rest of you? Yeah, Tegan.
I have a story. It's a little elaborate, but basically, you know, we can play with the rituals, and that's really the true spirit of the rituals, not to take them too seriously. So I have a story from a while back when I was a student at Tassajara. And you mentioned, Mark, Benedictine background, and there still is a Benedictine monk named Brother David Steindl-Rast, who's an old friend, and he was he used to come to Tassajara. He had actually done a practice period. He called himself a Zenedictine, actually. He used to be on the board at Zen Center. One day, he showed up unannounced at Tassajara just before noon service. And that day happened to be Halloween. And he came in for the service. And the doshi that day for the service was the director, who happened to be a very fine priest named Robert Lytle, who's Sarah's dad. Now passed away, because it was Halloween, Robert, he was officiating for the midday service. He was dressed up as Frankenstein's monster, and he walked into the zendo and came up to the to the altar and did the full service, but you know, looking like Frankenstein's monster. And I think he was a little embarrassed because he saw Brother David there, but he went, you know, he did it. And actually, his jisha, Brian was, whose name was Brian, was like Igor and like a hunchback. And anyway, and the rest of us were just there as regular monks. And later at work meeting, Brother David said, "That was wonderful. That proved to me that you take the rituals very seriously because you can play with them."
Right.
So that's my story about ritual and playing with ritual.
I might be able to add that flexibility is probably as important as precision in those forms. So, and relaxation.
Right.
You know, and there's just kind of a middle in there for everybody doing it, you know, for the first time, doing it again for the 10th time, you know, but like the rigid stuff, like it really doesn't work with Orioki, because inevitably the chopsticks go flying into the middle of the zendo or whatever, or you know, the priest trips over his robe or something. So, and it's bound to happen, even if you're, you know, you kind of do the flexibility and the precision thing, it's bound to happen. So the play thing is really, that's wonderful, because, and you look around and you see different degrees of of flexibility and relaxation and rigidity. It's very, very interesting. Well, you don't want to look around too much, because then you get in trouble too. But anyway, that's what I had to say about that.
Well, you bring up something that I was trying to say earlier and this is a good point, getting back to, Mark's question again, that there's something about being in a form or a ceremony and being open to the situation at hand. And what you described comically, things go on and around you. But I was thinking more about like the forms and ceremonies of like going to the grocery store. I mean, it's never the same. It's never the same. They're always different people. It feels different when you go in. If we're paying attention to what's around us and we have maybe a little playful spirit and we're in relationship with our environment that we're doing something with, it's interesting. It's alive. It's not just a deadening thing that we have to do as a form in our life. And you could probably make that case, Stephen, for washing the dishes, but I'm not sure.
One of my favorite rituals.
Alex, you were going to say something, Alex?
Tiger, go ahead.
No, I was just commenting that washing the dishes is one of my favorite rituals.
I was going to say on this topic, I spoke a little bit about this a few weeks back with the sort of how to keep it from being too rigid. And so, for me, my kind of story around this, the place my mind goes is that, I was spending a lot of time practicing doaning and sort of, ringing the bells at the certain time. And I had a lot of difficulty with it for a while, because for me, I'm the sort of person who can fall into the trap of, I need to be exactly on time. I need to ring the bell at 7:15, and then I need to ring the bell at 7:50, and it needs to be perfect. I need to get an A on this. And the sort of the thing that made it click for me was it's not about necessarily that, I guess maybe to put it simply or reductively, so take this for what it is, it's not about me as an individual getting the form or the ceremony correct, but it's about doing it in a way that harmonizes what's going on around us and puts things in a shared context together in the way that I think these shared rituals at least are supposed to. And so, Brian, I've heard this talk before. I was there at the Wednesday talk when you gave it, but of course it's not at all the same this time. And I've had 10 whole days of experience to think on it, and now I'm hearing it with fresh ears, and it's a different thing now. So,
yeah. Well, what you said, Alex, is interesting. The difference between I'm getting this right for myself and, as an isolated unit here, as opposed to how do I harmonize with my environment? I think we could say the same thing about the forms of daily life too. I love that often quoted portion of Dogen's Genjo Koan, to bring the self forward and experience myriad things is delusion. Well, if I'm in the grocery store, to use that example again, and it's all about me and what I want to get done and how long it's taking me and whether this person is annoying me or whether I can find the grape nuts today or not, or whether they're out of toilet paper once again, I'm wrapped up in myself and I'm bringing myself forward to experience myriad things and I'm in delusion. The other half of the saying is when myriad things come forth and experience themselves, it is awakening. So as other people come forward in my awareness and the situation at hand and the temperature in the room, and it's all those things come forth and experience themselves as they are, and I allow them to be there and I'm in some kind of harmony with them as I move through it, that is awakening. And I think that's along the lines of what you were saying about the being dawn, Alex. Yes, Ed.
Thank you, Brian, for your talk.
You're welcome.
You used the word intention quite a bit in your talk. In some way to grant a getter or to get some arrangement of what form looks like, proper form. However, the word intention, I've never quite, decades, I've always stumbled across that word. And I've never known really what to make of it, especially as regards to the possession of it or what it implies, the use of it. And I thought maybe you'd discuss that a little further.
Well, maybe we could start by you could tell me, is there a word that you would use for what you bring to a situation in order for you to be open to it? And what other word works for you there?
Oh, no. I love that word, intention.
Okay.
I think it's
where's the stumbling over it?
It's a little ambiguous as to it's who, the possessor of the intention, right? Is that when you say intention, that means a possession. And is the intention reside in the form or in the participant?
Well, I would say both. I think we bring our willingness, maybe that's another word for intention, our willingness, and the form itself has its own life, whether we're talking about Zazen or the grocery store. There is something in the energy of that total experience that has its own direction, perhaps, and we're moving with it together. Does that make sense?
So you're saying the form resides within the participant by intention?
Well, the form includes the participant, and the participant includes the form. It's there's no separation.
So the form is owned in a sense by the participant in the form.
I wouldn't use the word owned because I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that. But I would say I often think of this brings up the question of self and the world around us, and I like the image of the self as kind of like a house that has all the windows and doors open, and the environment outside that personal self is kind of blowing through, and we allow it in, and it comes in and out, and there isn't really any separation.
So you're saying the form cannot exist without the participant?
Without all participants.
Another way maybe is that the participants bring the form to life, give it life, bring it alive.
So then the form exists as a kind of a gift?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Good questions. Alex?
Yeah? I think this is very interesting, and I wonder about... is intention a possession, something that I have, or is it an orientation? Is it a direction that I face, or a direction that I choose to face? And it makes me think of something that Fushin said last Wednesday when she mentioned a sort of distinction between this idea of paying attention, like it's this transaction, versus attending to something.
Mm-hmm. Fushin, is there anything about Alex's comment that brings to mind what you were talking about in terms of that and tonight's discussion?
You're going to put me on the spot, right?
Well, you can say, I don't know. That's fine.
Yes. No, everything. So I love this conversation and the question about the gift, the giving of intentionality. I mean, you have that word too, right? That has to do with direction It has to do with kind of currents. So kind of, you know, reading the currents of like the ocean, you know, how that all works. I mean, when you're sailing, you kind of have to read how the water is moving. Well, I mean, you're kind of one of the currents in the ocean too.
Right.
So, we're all reading each other kind of, you know, if we're attending to one another, if we're in touch with one another, if we're giving ourselves to each other. How about that?
Yeah, it gets to the whole question is, what is the self? I mean, that line in the Katagiri verses that I read to you about all things are become the content of the self, that you know, keep bringing up this example of a grocery store. I don't know why, but walking—it's a complex environment. When I walk into it, it's creating me, and I'm creating it. I mean, what is Brian in that moment? What is the grocery store? You know, we're all giving rise to this event together.
And yet,
rather than me having this experience of this object of reality around me, this subject that is interacting with these objects, you know.
But you need the grape nuts.
Ah, you do, yeah.
All right, let's date ourselves. That was Yul Gibbons with Grape Nuts.
Yeah, that's great. Yes, David.
Brian, thanks for the talk very much. Thanks for talking about Zazen and sacramental theology and ex opere operato together. I mean, that's a thing from my, you know, spiritual formation that I really love, and it makes me happy to hear it in this context. That's the main thing I want to say, but let me see if I can make that sound like a question or at least a comment. But I really just wanted to say yay, that was awesome. But I guess, you know, I'm thinking about how, you know, all that stuff is based on Aristotelian physics and metaphysics, which when you delve into it is as mystical and psychedelic as anything in a Buddhist sutra, right? Like for Aristotle, my soul becomes the form of a frog when I cognize a frog. I mean, that sounds a lot like saying that when I sit Zazen, everything is sitting Zazen. And when Zazen is Zazen, you know, Buddha gets to be Buddha, or Buddha is Buddha. I would love to hear more of your thoughts about like the inner experience of Zazen as enactment ritual. You talked about, you know, sitting and being in the posture and the mudra, but I kind of feel like whatever it is that I do cognize or how I be in Zazen feels like that's enactment ritual too.
Hmm. You know, I think I, years ago, I might have said that when my mind settles down and when the so-called distractions are fewer and further between them, and I'm in this kind of peaceful present state, that's enactment. I used to think that way. But I don't experience it that way anymore. That experience happens, and so do a lot of others. And there are a lot of thoughts coming and going, and there's the and I think it's all enactment that samsara is nirvana, and the working with what is there, whether we think of it as delusion or enlightenment, is a flow that is happening, and to work with it is awakening. To bring, maybe desire is a good word rather than intention into it. Ed, you look like you're about to say something.
Well, just to add maybe something in response to what you're saying exactly there, in reference to David's question, you're stating you are establishing the fact of your existence as that of a creator in some ways. You're creating this ritual, this form. You are creating it. So you're making that connection for me by your talk. And creation is necessary. That's an outcome from intention, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're in the grocery store, you're creating, I mean, I hate that scenario, but you're, because I can think of being in Costco, it's very stressful, but you're creating, you're assuming an right. obligation, you're taking the position of a creator. So that's a recognition of power too.
It is. And I used to think, I guess what I was trying to say about Zazen in response to David's question about the internal experience of it is that I used to think that creating, let's call it awakening at Costco, is getting past the stress so I can be peaceful and create a harmonious aura around myself and other people will benefit from that somehow. That's not how I see it anymore. It's really to recognize that whatever we're doing, even our stress, is creating the environment that is there. And there's a difference between being aware of that and not being aware. And we're all doing it at the same time. Tygen, you had your hand up.
Yes. Two things. Going back to my talk yesterday in response to Ed, on some level, we're creating all of it. But also, there's the shared physical world. There's the shared collective karma that we're responsible for how we respond to it, but we are not making it. So there's this communal collective karma. So the grocery store, in some ways we walk into the grocery store and we're creating it. In another way, it exists independent of us, or as a collective expression of all beings, not just because of me and my idea of my ego self. So just to say that in response to what you said, Ed. But the other thing is, I'm glad to hear what you just said, Brian. It's not that our Zazen should be some particular wonderful, luminous state. And in some way, even when we are so-called daydreaming, in Zazen, part of the point of Zazen is how do we Fuxian, how do we give attention to what's happening in the midst of the chaos of thoughts, feelings, conditions, etc., whatever they are. That is the training for us to be responsive in this crazy world we live in, when we get up from our cushion. So we chanted the song of the grass hut by Shuto. Shuto also said, the blue sky is not hindered, or we could say, is not distracted by white clouds drifting. So it's okay if clouds arise, if clouds drift by. The blue sky is still there. Some of the clouds are interesting and they form interesting shapes. So that's also part of the enactment of the ritual of Zazen. And we don't have to... Zazen is not only when all the clouds are gone. Right. Sometimes that happens. It's a clear blue sky. And sometimes there's lots of clouds. And either way, it's the ritual enactment of whatever you want to call it. So just to add that.
Well, we don't have to force ourselves to stay till 9, but if there are other comments or questions, they're certainly welcome. Otherwise, we can get on with our evenings.
I have a question for Tygen, but it had something to do with one of his comments not relating to the Dharma talk. So when it ends, if he could just stay for a few seconds, I have a question for him.
Sure. But maybe other people want to hear it too.
I was on a previous call earlier to this with a sangha that is connected to Thich Nhat Hanh, and they were looking at social justice issues and the importance of following, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh's teaching. And my question was, has Parallel Press ever put out a book that this is Thich Nhat Hanh's saying on this, 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 and this? And the answer was no. There's got to be a way for that to happen, because they have access to all their, I'm sure all of their books are digital now.
Well, I don't know. It's been a long time since I worked for Parallax Press, but I do highly recommend the 14 precepts of the Order of Interbeing as a commentary on our 10 precepts. And that has a lot of, in terms of just the principles of response to how we respond to social justice.
Sure.
And just as a plug, I'll mention that my friend Alan Sinaki is going to be here, be giving a talk on Zoom in August, on a Monday evening in August, about Buddhism and social justice.
Huh.
And actually, by way of announcements, next Sunday, Florence Kaplow, who's also I don't know what her topic is, but she will be talking, and she's also a very good Buddhist priest and teacher who talks about social justice, although she's also a Unitarian minister. So
I would like to know more information on that Buddhist talk on social justice.
Well, look on our website and look at the schedule of talks.
Okay, I will. One comment I did have, I think it was Ed that was talking about the clouds rising up. And I remember when I first got into Buddhism about 20 years ago, a good friend of mine got me Ashvaghosha's book, The Awakening of the Mind. And his little saying at the end of his treatise was the meditation, the past is hazy as a dream, the present is like lightning, and the future is like clouds rising up suddenly. And throughout the years, I've always tried to keep that in mind, because it's real easy for me to think about the future and try to manipulate things so that drama doesn't happen. But then I miss the present moment. And that's what it's all about, is this present moment. That's all we have.
Sorry, I could say a lot about that. If people want to leave, they can, but I'm going to actually be teaching that text next spring, and I'm just starting to look at it again. I read it many years ago. And I think Fushin has been studying that text, and there's a new translation of it. But I would say that the present moment, I talked about this a little bit, I think, yesterday. Anyway, the present moment includes the past and the future, and in the present moment we can change the past. So, and that's what's happening now, actually, these days. That's a whole big topic. I was just wondering what I should talk about Wednesday night, if I should keep talking about the Vox koan. Maybe I should talk about time. I don't know.
That's interesting. Thank you.
Anyway,
could you say again? You mentioned a 14-point commentary on the 10 precepts. What I I was trying to jot down what you said, and I apologize, you know, that I'm not appearing.
It's Ken. I can see you right up. Hi, Ken.
Hi.
Thich Nhat Hanh's 14 precepts for the order of interbeing, and they're in some of the Thich Nhat Hanh books. I think in Being Peace, maybe. If you email me, Ken, I can send you a copy.
Okay. Thank you.
Or anybody else who wants.